couple of announcements here. As you know, or should know, there will be no Bible class through Thursday through the end of May. And secondarily, in regard to the 30th anniversary celebration, we will take offerings for that, which will determine, you know, what we actually do in terms of the celebration, probably up through about the 1st of September. By then, we have to have our budget pretty well fixed. So ideally, really, the middle of August, we probably will look at it at the board meeting. So if you do decide to contribute to that, again, mark your offering appropriately so that it goes to funds for that rather than just into the general fund. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with this matter of the old sin nature. Roman numeral 2 here deals with the divine blueprint for mankind. A, the creation of Adam and Eve forms the blueprint for the method by which God continues to create men and women. B, although the bodies of Adam and Eve were directly fashioned by God, this is not necessary after original creation, since bodies are now formed genetically via physical procreation. The physical birth process isn't that hard to understand. The body is formed genetically out of existing material. And obviously, if you can imagine what sort of evolution would have had to occur for you to go from a single-celled organism in day one to a body 9 months later. Now, that's tremendous evolution and fast. I mean, for cells, and we're talking about, if you know anything about the physical body, the specialized nature of cells. Cells all do different stuff. They all have different functions. And so the body is formed in 9 months from a single cell to a fully formed functioning human being. That come out of the womb capable of supporting life on its own. Till then, it's not. Well, there's a clear distinction between the formation of the body, which occurred first, and the creation of the soul. One, the first evidence is that different Hebrew terms are used for the creation of the soul and for the formation of the body. A, the Hebrew term bara is used in Genesis to denote creation out of nothing. Now, this is one of the instances in which you have to be very careful. Any exegete does. But this term bara is not technical. It doesn't always mean creation out of nothing. So to say that would be to go on the bounds of what the text will support. But in Genesis, it's only used of that. It's only used of creation out of ex nihilo, which means out from nothing, literally from the Latin. And this term is used of the creation of the soul. Genesis 1:27, it was also used, of course, in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God, barad, the heaven and the earth. Again, the definite article is really not there in the Genesis account. The translators supply it. But there are a number of beginnings. Here, we're talking about original creation, when God spoke everything into existence and everything came into being. The earth, and then everything that's not the earth, the heavens. And some have argued, well, there was nothing in the heavens. It was all just empty. The only thing was there, the earth, and one big empty space. And they can't prove that. They argue that. I understand that. But that's just an argument from silence. If you believe in a perfectly formed physical creation, then God spoke it all into existence at once. And those, again, who get into Genesis have many problems because they want to take this and make all of Genesis restoration, essentially, refer to original creation. Restoration took place in a literal 6 24-hour days. But the earth was created long before that. We just don't know how long. Now, some people don't like this, and they have referenced it, the gap theory, that there certainly is that something happens between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. Of that, there is no question, because you're just given this bare statement. God created the heavens and the earth. And obviously, that focuses the reader immediately on the earth, because it stands out from the heavens. It's different. And the earth became. Literally, haya, the Hebrew verb, means to become. There is no to-be verb in the Hebrew language. And so when you see, but now haya does double duty because of that. It can mean to be something, Because once something becomes something, it is that. You know, that ice was reduced, it became a puddle of water. Well, it melted. I know what happened. And it became something that it wasn't. And that is, it became liquid when it was solid. Here, the earth became something it wasn't. It became formless, which means that the original creation, the earth had great form and structure and beauty. But it became formless. And by formless, it just means that wherever you looked, it was just basically all the same. There was no distinguishing features. Now, how did it become this way? Well, the key is here, as we're going to see, God packed the earth in water and then froze it. And it became void. Void means void of inhabitants. It means that there were inhabitants on the earth. Who were they? And why are they run off of the earth? That's the question that the theologian has to answer. And this was not its original state. It was meant to be inhabited. And so the Hebrew terms here, tohu, formless, and bohu, void, void of inhabitants. And darkness was over the surface of the deep. The deep means great depths of water. It doesn't just mean a lake. We're talking Mariana's Trench deeps. We're talking miles, possibly, of water on the surface of the earth. We don't really know. But it just says it was over the surface of the deep. The earth was no longer being seen. It was there, but you couldn't see it. And the Spirit of God was hovering, moving over the surface of the waters. And the verb used here is that of a hen brooding over her eggs to hatch them, to warm them, so that they hatch. And the Spirit of God is moving, or literally warming, the surface of the waters. And why? Well, as we're going to see, God is going to restore the planet. The inhabitants that were run off were Satan and his demons. You know, remember those when they first came out with Star Wars a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, there was a rebellion. This is the galaxy. This is where it happened. Satan's desire was to rule over planet Earth. And it was the pristine and probably the pinnacle of all of God's creation. And so Satan wanted this place. And that's what began, in some ways, the battle. Certainly after Satan's fall, the battle is who's going to rule planet Earth. God says he's going to. I've read the end of the book. He wins. Through Jesus Christ. All things will be summed up in him, be reconciled in him. And so there you have Bara. In the beginning, God created. He spoke this into existence out of nothing. Now, God the Father, as it were, spoke it. God the Son is the one who actually executed it. He did the physical labor involved in manufacturing the universe in a moment of time. And just as he has spoken it into existence, he is going to speak it out of existence again at some point. That's very clearly taught in 2 Peter. And know this, that the universe will melt all the elements with intense heat. So if you can find an element on the periodic table, if you can't, I don't know what to tell you. Because there's nothing but elements on the periodic table. If you can find an element on the periodic table, you can easily, readily research its melting point. And some of these elements require high melting points. Gold is one of those. As you heat this up, and if you're composed out of elements, let me tell you what's going to happen to you at that time. You're going to melt. So you can't have a physical mortal body at the time he speaks the universe out of existence. Because you couldn't handle it. You couldn't stand it. You couldn't survive it. When carbon melts, it's going to be rough on carbon-based life forms. Which we are, unfortunately. So here he speaks out of nothing. He creates out of nothing. Out of no material whatsoever. He makes something. Who has that capacity? Wouldn't you like to be able to do that? Just create. Well, be the term used for the formation of the body of man is yatser, which emphasizes the shaping or forming of an object from some material. That's seen in 2:7. See, the term used for the formation of the body of the woman is bana, which is often used for constructing a house. This indicates that Eve was built to specifications for the benefit of Adam. and obviously for the purpose of establishing a family. 128, they have to rule over. He tells them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth with progeny, with children, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And man's given authority, sovereignty over the planet. And of course, today, now, the do-gooders and all of that, is the environment changing? Possibly. There's not enough information. They say, well, we got tons of information. Yeah, but it's not over a statistically long enough period of time to make valid observations, even. Man hasn't been on the earth over 6,000 years. And when they tell you, well, these could just be literal cycles that happen all the time, stretched out over tens of thousands of years, it really could. We don't know. And so, of course, I don't agonize about it, because being a believer, I know all of this is going to stay together until God doesn't need it. And then he'll speak it out of existence. So I'm not agonizing over, is the one-inch tapeworm going extinct? I hope they do. And I'm supposed to agonize over this, or worry about why we can't build a solar array, because we have to concern ourselves with, that poor plane that slid off the runway, it killed some fish. Oh my God. What did red tide do? We don't. You know, why haven't they fixed that? You know, nobody, and everybody hates that. Everybody hates that uniformly. So rule over these things gave them authority. And Genesis 2:18 deals with the formation of the woman. And the Lord God said, and if you read Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, it's dominated by the terms, it was good. It was good. It was good. Everything God did was good. There was nothing wrong with it. Morally good, spiritually good, physically good, beneficial, helpful. Here's the first thing we're told, it is not good. So this stands out like a big red light in the middle if you're exegeting these verses. It is not good. What is not good? Loneliness. It's not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. So out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a creature, that was its name. So he gave names to all the cattle, all the birds of the sky, every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not a helper suitable for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. Divine anesthesia. And he slept. And then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib, which he had taken from the man, and brought her to the woman. See, a man's constructed of dust of the earth. Woman's constructed from man's rib. And there are tons of spiritual lessons in here as well. I don't have time to stop and deal with them now. But there's a lot in here that can be gleaned as to how God does this and why. And the relationship, the fundamental marital relationship, and how it is to be handled comes out of all this. The term used for her is bana there. And two, the second evidence is the stated order in which man was actually formed. Genesis 1 details the planning stage for the formation of mankind, but not the actual execution. Genesis 2 provides the actual creation of the body and soul of man, with the body being formed first from the dust of the ground. If you understand, of course, you really have to, and this is where, obviously, as a sheep, you're never going to get this, apart from somebody instructing you. You'd never figure this out on your own. But you have to understand how Moses writes, and what he's doing, and what his goal is in constructing the book of Genesis, even. Some people may think, well, under inspiration, these guys just sit down and wrote what came to them, and it was all fine and perfect, and that's true to some extent. But it's not totally true. And these men, really, when you look at their writings, you look at Paul's writing, how complex is a 202-word sentence? That's very complex. So he did this on purpose, though, to drive people like me insane. But I'm not going to let him. I don't care how crazy he is. Now I'm working on the next 189-word sentence. So, there's about 7 really long sentences in Ephesians. In excess of 100 words each time. All of them, I think. So you have to understand how Paul writes and why. Matter of fact, I'm dealing with my big question I'm wrestling with right now is in chapter 3, is where, why does he do this digression he does? Why does he start off and then just go off and deal with something that seems to be apparently unrelated to what his purpose is? Well, I know it can't be unrelated, but there's no consensus on why he does this. So I'm working on that one. But here, how does Moses write? Well, Moses starts at the beginning, in the beginning. And then he advances his narrative to a point. And then he stops. Then he goes back and picks up at another point, subsequent, previous to that, previous to where he stopped. And then he advances his narrative to another point. And then he stops. Then he backs up and he does this again. And each time he doesn't go back further. He always goes back a certain point and then he picks up. And this is divided in the Old Testament by the noun toledoth, translated by the English term generations. These are the generations of such and such. And that's how he writes. Well, in Genesis 1, he's advanced it to the point of, and as a matter of fact, if you read the end of Genesis 1 there, he gets to the execution stage, where obviously he's already created him in verse 28. So the first week's over with by Genesis 28. But then when you get into chapter 2, there's an account of creation. Well, how do you reconcile that with the fact that clearly in verse 28, when it said God blessed them, they must have already been created? That all that we read in chapter 2 must have happened. Well, this explains it. This, because he gets to a point, then he backs up and recapitulates part of that, and then continues to advance the narrative. And so, this has driven interpreters crazy, because they said, well, this is all messed up. He gets out of order. He's not. No. If you just know how he writes, that makes it a whole lot easier. And then God said, behold, I have given you every green plant. And everything yielding seed. And at the end of verse 31 here, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and morning the sixth day. So man and woman have been created here by Genesis 1. Well, how does Genesis 2 help this? It's because Adam backs up and fills in some detail that's germane to what he's taught. Or Moses does. I'm sorry, Adam. Moses does. So again, see here now, therefore Adam was first physically formed, and then God created his soul. Imputed it to his body in a process Moses records as breathing into his nostrils the breath of life. And the fact is, in reality, what is the first thing anybody in the emergency realm will check for to determine how the patient is? Are they breathing? That's kind of important. It's a big deal. You can't go long without breathing. You can go some days without water. You can go even longer without food. But you can't go without breathing very long. Or really, really bad stuff happens. And we know what those things are. So here, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And thirdly, the imputation of anything demands a target for the imputation. The same is true of the soul, which requires a human body as its target. And so what happens if a baby, fully formed, is stillborn? God didn't impute a soul. That's the simple answer, and that's all it takes. God didn't impute a soul. You say, well, what did the parents do wrong? God determines this. And people want these simple answers. Well, the parents must have done something. Not necessarily. Now, that's the same simplistic type thinking Jesus rebuked in the disciples. When they said, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Well, first, that's a dumb question. Who sinned this man that he was born blind? How could he have sinned before he was born? That's a dumb question. But people want to blame bad things on sin. Well, sin does bring bad things. We're not debating that. But Jesus said it was neither this man or his parents. Dummies. That was, you know, he was born this way for the works of God to be manifest in him. And so here's a man born blind. Nobody had ever heard of this. The healing of a man born blind. People had gone blind and had sight restored. But born blind? No. And then, of course, this really sets off his enemies, as you know. If one recognizes that the soul and body are separate, the body being formed from existing material and the soul coming by an act of creation from God, He could avoid a lot of confusion and emotionalism about the nature of life. One, God did not create all souls at once. Disembodied souls are not floating around heaven waiting for bodies. They are being created on a daily basis. This was one of the reasons, not the only reason, but this was one of the reasons Jesus could say they were all upset about the Sabbath, because the Sabbath God rested. Now, why did God rest? Well, from the human perspective, we have to say he was tired. You're tired. And you got to rest. And so God had to rest. And as far as the Jews knew, God was still resting. They'd never heard anything different. And Jesus comes along working on the Sabbath, and he said, my Father works and I continue to work. My Father works all the time. First, he's creating souls. How much work is that for you? Oh, we can't do it? That's a lot of work. Nothing for God, of course. But for us, how do you create a soul? And what's involved in a soul? I mean, really? All the things that go to that. Well, two, the false doctrine of Traducianism states that parents generate an immortal soul along with a physical body. Oh, my God. Uh-oh. And so you'll hear people say this. I created you. No, you didn't. You had a part in it. But you did not create me, the real me, the soul, the invisible me. God created me. And I used to be one of my mom's favorite lines. I created you, I can take you out. I mean, she didn't really mean it. I know what she, as a child, it was her way of trying to put her bluff over on me, so I'd obey her. I understood what was going on. I didn't really think she'd kill me. My parents weren't abusive in that regard at all. I mean, we got spankings, but I got away with more than I got, so I should have gotten a lot more than I did, but that's a whole different story. So again, traditionism says, okay, you have sex and this generates an immortal soul. That's why every sperm is sacred. You understand that this is life, according to these people. Well, it's not. They do not generate souls. You cannot take two physical things and make a spiritual thing. What do you add together? I can put red and yellow and get orange. But I can't do that. I can't put two things together like that. Well, see, creationism teaches that the soul is formed by God and imputed at the point of conception. However, there is no evidence that a soul can be interfaced with a single cell, but apparently requires the specialized cell within the brain as a point of interface. My argument would be you have to have a point of interface for the soul in which it can actually function. If it can't function, what's the point? So to say that it's there, to say that the soul is there in the womb, there's no biblical proof of that. And this, people would avoid a lot of this emotionalism. Now, are we advocating abortion? I'm not advocating abortion. I'm saying, however, that there is no soul life in the womb. The soul life comes when God imputes the soul at the point of birth. And what people do, but how many Christians are out there wasting their time, wasting their days, agonizing over abortion? What are you going to do about it? First, you can't even prove that your position is right. Not biblically, you cannot. You can't prove. Now, again, we're not advocating for abortion. We're not saying, oh, well, there's no soul, so just do what you want. There may be repercussions to doing, to taking that fetus. I don't know. But the fact is, I'm not going to go out and protest when they do it, because number one, I know they haven't. See, here's the key element in their argument. We are here to defend the unborn. The unborn. Well, if they're not unborn, if they're unborn, they don't exist. You're arguing for the defense of the non-existent. Well, if then we're going to have to defend everything, because so many things don't exist. Where are we going to draw the line on that one? I mean, you can't. So it's a real slippery slope. And believers, you should be thoughtful. You should think through these things. Understand these things clearly. You could avoid a lot of emotionalism and all of this. And what people are going to do, they're going to do anyway. Really, how you feel about it, even if you think there's life in the womb, which there's not. If you think that, it doesn't hurt anybody for you to think that. Unless you want to go out and blow up an abortion clinic. Well, no, we can't have that. We're not God's police. We're not here for that, unfortunately or fortunately. So the question would be, it's tantamount, I'm thinking, to trying to boot a computer without an operating system. How do you do that? How do you boot a computer with no operating system? The operating system already has to be on the hard drive, or you can't do it. So God gives life, and it comes from Him. So statements like, I knew you from the womb. Well, first, it's generally out from, ek, with the ablative, which means I knew you when you came out of the womb. But even for the places where it says, I knew you when you were in the womb, obviously God's foreknowledge existed to eternity. He knew me 6 million years ago. To say that He knows me when I'm in the womb doesn't violate that or prove anything different. He's always known me. At least in His mind. He knew me before I existed. But that's knowledge. How do you get your mind around that? So, again, although the Old Testament does not appear to prescribe the death penalty for the death of an unborn child, the passage is open to another interpretation. Exodus 21 is somewhat important in this argument, or discussion is all it really should be. It should never degenerate into arguing, but if two men struggle with each other, Exodus 21:22, and they strike a woman with child. Well, a woman with child is a pregnant woman, not a woman who has a child in her arms. A woman with child, so that she gives birth prematurely. What follows there makes it clear they're talking about a pregnant woman. She gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. And he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. This is the civil code that makes for an organized, civilized society. If people know that if I steal your car, you're going to take mine. If I take your life, the government's going to take mine. That if they know this helps deter certain behaviors, certain bad behaviors. That she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury. He shall be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. But what happens if the baby comes out and is stillborn? What happens if there's a death, as it were? The child doesn't get born. Well, the passage doesn't really address that. Not in explicit language, at any rate. And so some have argued here, well, it's saying if there is no other injury, he gets a fine. But the term here, give birth prematurely, may be interpreted in two ways. And one is to give birth prematurely, and the other is to miscarry. That if she miscarries. But obviously a miscarriage is a death then, at that sense. You've lost the fetus. So then what happens? Well, the passage doesn't address it. But you would think if it was a life, that God would say that this is governed by the death penalty. That you have to kill the guy if he does this, if they're fighting and this happens. And clearly, this is an incident in which it was not intentional. It was not premeditated. They just happened to be fighting and she was in the way, or they got her, whatever reason. Five, the evidence of soul life is apparently the same as for everyone, as it was for Adam. And that is the breath of life. We saw that in Genesis 2:7, Job 27:3. He talks about life in terms of breath. And this is the same term, again, in the Hebrew, the neshama. As long as life is within me. And the breath of God is in my nostrils. And it uses exactly that, the term for nose. So you can say, well, it's the spark of life. Yeah, but it's manifested by breath, by moving wind. That's how it's manifested. And the breath of God is in my nostrils. There he equates life with breath in a parallel statement. Also 34:14. I think that was the one we looked at earlier where he can take them all. Yeah. Here again translated by the term breath. If he should gather to himself his spirit and his breath. They're using a parallel situation using spirit and breath where Job used life and breath earlier. So F, throughout the lifetime of the individual, The soul remains interfaced with the brain until God determines to end that connection through physical death. Again, whatever the cause of death, automobile accident, lung cancer, liver cancer, heart attack, stroke, cause of death, God pulled the Nishama. That's the cause of death. That in the end is it. Decapitated in a car wreck, Nishama was pulled. Hopefully just before you got decapitated. Now, that would be better. Ideally, I would think. Well, gee, when Adam was created, he was endowed with the ability to understand and enjoy a relationship with God by means of his human spirit. 1 Corinthians 2, we know that the human spirit is the means by which people may know God. That apart from that, they really can't grasp these things. And this is where we get, again, the gap doctrine out of this, the entire process. And that is that we have received the Spirit who is from God, so that we might know the things freely given to us by God. Apart from the Spirit, you cannot know these things. You have to be a believer, and you have to be in fellowship, and you have to want to know them. That's a part of positive volition. How badly do you want it? Again, which are taught here, Paul's speaking about doctrinal teaching at this point. But the fact is, apart from the Spirit, there's no point of interface to deal with God. He is a spiritual being. You can only deal with him at a spiritual level in that regard. So H, at creation, Adam was trichotomous, containing three parts, possessing a body, a soul, and a human spirit. And that's how we find man in his initial status, tripartite. Unfortunately, that doesn't last long. And some have argued, well, you know, we don't know how long Adam and Eve, maybe they were in the garden. See, they want to stretch this out in many cases. This is why some people don't like the, quote, gap theory. They say, well, you're trying to insert a bunch of ages in there that so you can justify evolution. No, I'm not. Number one, it's based on the grammar of the text. The earth became something it wasn't. What happened? And you have to account for that. And until you answer that question, you haven't effectively answered Genesis 1-2. And what we do know is we don't know how long it was. We don't know when original creation was. Could God have created the entire universe billions of years ago? He could have. I doubt it, though. There's pretty good scientific evidence that the universe itself isn't much over 10,000 years old. Several proofs can be offered of this. One of them is the rate of decay of the magnetic field of things. That if the magnetic fields decay at a particular rate, just like elements do, their half-lives are determined at very specific rates. And this is easily calculatable, verifiable, and documentable, that these things deteriorate. If the Earth, or if the universe were more than about 10 or 12,000 years old, you go back any further than that and the sun's essentially a magnetic star. And it's not like what we have now at all. There are various types of proofs of things like this, that the Earth may not be nearly as old as people think. But the bigger question isn't so much how old is the Earth. Do not get into arguments with people about that. You're wasting your time. Because the answer is nobody knows. Here's your answer. Nobody knows. Nobody knows specifically. And why do we say, well, the Earth may be much younger? Well, number one, the Earth was created with an illusion of age, don't you know? That when God spoke it into existence, it's only 1 second old. But what did mountains look like? Did the rocks appear to have the appearance of age? Or did you say, oh, that's a brand new rock? Trees. I mean, he spoke it all into existence. Were there just little pieces of trees, or were there full-grown trees there? When he created Adam, was he just a little peanut? Or was he a fully grown human man? And so things are created with an illusion of age. And so to know that says, okay, well, I can look at a universe that may only be 10,000 years old or 12. And it may look much older. It may seem much older. But again, carbon dating doesn't work. Anybody that understands science truly knows that this is not an accurate method of determining anything, because it relies on a closed system. And it also relies on a uniformitarian system. And you know what we have? Neither of those. It is neither a closed system. The Earth and the universe, the Earth interacts with the universe. It is not isolated in a terrarium, as it were. And the universe interacts with the earth. And secondarily, it's not only not a closed system, the reality is you can check out the rates of decay of certain things, but it's not a uniformitarian system either. There have been major catastrophes that have affected the entire planet. There was, and science will even acknowledge this, the smarter ones will, that there was an extinction event for the dinosaurs. The Ice Age is portrayed and thought about by most as just ludicrous. The dinosaurs, you know, I think it's a degree colder today. This encroaching Ice Age as these glaciers crept, as it were, southward and absorbed everything. And animals were too stupid to move, huh? What do they move at? 6, 8, 10 inches a day? But there's evidence. You go out, you know, as they unearth these woolly mammoths and various things and find entire animals intact. Well, that's not the... That's a cataclysmic event. That's not. That's a sudden event. That's an extinction event. And it's very possible that whatever it was that hit the earth hit down here around the Yucatan. There is a huge impression down there. That they pretty much suspect that might be where it is. So the earth was suddenly plunged into almost cold, bordering on absolute zero. Well, how long will that take to flash freeze something? You know, they put things in a freezer. Oh, we did it. We went to Alaska. They put our fish flash frozen in the freezer overnight. Well, ours didn't work out quite so well, but it comes out solid as a rock. And that's in a period of less than 12 hours. Now, we're talking about however cold they can get their freezer. Let's say it's 25 or 30 below in there. Do you know what absolute zero is? We're talking about the kind of cold that permeates space. We're talking about cold on an order that people can't fathom. Being introduced all of a sudden into, by the way, a subtropical environment. What would happen there? Study of meteorology tells us, number one, there are going to be very, very, very high winds. And various catastrophes that are going to come out of this. And people say, well, yeah, precipitated out the canopy. It rained for 40 days. That wasn't the problem. The 40 days of rain had very little to do with the flood. Although it rained here for about 4 days straight back in 93, for those of you, or 94, somewhere in there. And the entire Sarasota was just about underwater. You couldn't hardly go anywhere without going risking your car running. You don't know how deep the water is. People we had staying with us out of that time, they were out on the beach. We were probably, I'd say, 100 yards from the shore, and the water was waist deep. So... And that's out on the key. But it was same thing was true in the low-lying areas here. I don't know how much. We spent 30 minutes one night trying to drive 5 minutes home because we couldn't find a route that wasn't underwater. So that had very little to do with flooding the whole earth. The idea that, well, the flood came because of the rain. No, that contributed very little to it. The flood came from the underground caverns that contained massive amounts of water that were unleashed. The great fountains of the deep were busted open. And water just came flooding out onto the planet in ways that had never been seen, of course. So here now, let's move on with the fall of man here, the origin of the old sin nature and the results. Adam and Eve were created in a state of perfection and placed in a perfect environment. They were subjected to only one prohibition. This is pretty easy. This isn't challenging. This isn't difficult. The Lord commanded the man, say, and you recognize here, this doesn't say it's sawa in the Hebrew, which means to issue a commandment or a directive order. It doesn't say the Lord recommended. The Lord gave his advice. This is a command. This is a, you've got to do it. I've got the authority and you got to obey. From any tree of the garden, you may eat freely. But from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat. For in the day you eat from it, you will surely die. Now, is that straightforward and plain? And it is. It's very clear. Don't eat from this one tree. That's it. Well, being given what we know of the perfection of God, it should be evident that God is not the sponsor of evil or sin at any level. Adam and Eve were perfect in body, soul, and spirit. So this is where, many years ago, this doctrine of, and I listened to it and at first embraced it, but having studied the scriptures, found that there's no merit to it at all. This doctrine of the sinful trend of Adam. Adam did not have a sinful trend. That's just the terminology's wrong. And this is based on people who didn't do sufficient study. In some cases, one guy who didn't even know the languages at the time he's teaching this doctrine. The sinful trend of Adam. Adam didn't have a sinful trend. That would make God the author of evil. Who are you going to blame that on? You say, well, Adam developed a sinful trend. A text? Anything that might prove that? You can say it all you want. But you got no biblical proof of that. Adam was faced with one simple test. Sex in the garden with the woman or life with God apart from her? Men. Men. Which one did he pick, you think? Well, he picked the one that most men would have. Probably all men. And if you'd seen Eve, you'd probably know why. She puts these anorexic models to shame. Here, God is not the author of evil, but each one here. James 1, actually should be 13, I think is the one I want here. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil. And he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted. Where does temptation come from? When he is carried away and enticed by his own lust pattern. Temptation comes now for us internally. It comes from the body. It doesn't come from God. And then 1 John 1:5. Using a light and darkness analogy to deal with the matter of righteousness and evil, of love and hate, of the opposites that we find in the angelic conflict. This is the message that we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light. And in him, we say, there is no darkness at all. And so darkness is tantamount, is equivalent to the idea of sin and evil and all of that. God doesn't know anything about evil. There's nothing in him that can generate evil. So, Eve manifested characteristics or trends that were not sinful in themselves, but which ultimately led to eating from the forbidden fruit. Genesis 3 is the text for this that documents readily that, one, Satan's pretty smart. And again, why I am not advocating that they were in the garden for very long is based on two or three different strands of evidence. Number one, God tells him to be fruitful and multiply, which means have sex and children. And so people say, well, God didn't let him do that. God stopped it. Well, no, that doesn't make any sense. God doesn't give commands and then tell you, I'm going to keep you from fulfilling it. That would make God stupid. God's not stupid. He doesn't tell people to do things and then stop them from doing it. So first, they were commanded, and they were apparently a normal male-female couple. Physiologically normal. So Eve would have been fertile. And apparently, after they came out of the garden, it did not take her long to get pregnant. So my suspicion is she wasn't in there long. And secondarily, how long do you think Satan's going to wait to attack? Well, let me let them get their feet on the ground and really get thinking and get this under them and really establish their relationship. Oh, no. Satan's not an idiot. He's going to go right away. He knows that these people are ill-prepared or woefully under-equipped when it comes to him. He knows how smart he is. And he's still pretty smart. He's corrupt, but he's smart. So, she manifested characteristics or trends. Again, not sinful in themselves. One, she manifested a lack of clarity with respect to the actual command. Well, let's read this text here. Now, the serpent was, and literally became, it's not was, the serpent wasn't made this way. Something happened to the serpent that changed him. The serpent became more crafty than any other beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, indeed, has God said you shall not eat from any tree in the garden? So what's he do? Immediately, let me get you focused on the one thing you can't have. Did God say you can't have any of this? No, God only said this. Oh, there you go. Think about that. That's right where he wanted the conversation to go, and it's right where it went. And you think this guy's not a genius at manipulation. And the woman said to the serpent, "From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. But from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die." Couple of things here, a little bit of a problem. When she uses this phrase, in the middle of the garden, let's see if God had actually put that tree there. The term middle of the garden, well, let's try this here. Let me do something else. But the reality is, and if I remember correctly, and I'm pretty sure I do here, the It's nice the New American Standard doesn't like to use the same words each time. Same phrase. Out of the ground, the Lord caused every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. In other words, there's trees that are, aesthetically pleasing. You look at them, you think, that's a nice tree. But the good for food ones are better. You know, the ones that have oranges and apples and peaches and all that. And the tree of life he also planted in the middle of the garden. Wait a minute, that's the tree of life. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So you can make a couple of arguments here. Number one, the tree of life is distinctly said to be in the middle of the garden. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil may have been side by side with it. But I still think the tree of life had the primacy, that it was the focal point of the garden. And they did not eat of that one. But then you get into chapter 3 and she says the tree of the knowledge. She's focused on the one tree she can't have. Even if it's close by the tree of life, which it may have been, that's what she's focused on. And he manipulated her right to where he wanted her to go. But from the tree, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die. Well, did God say you couldn't touch it? No. They could touch the fruit. They could touch the tree. They could chop it down. They could burn it. They could do anything they wanted to with it. They could dance around it naked. They probably did. They didn't die. You know, you could have probably, as long as you didn't eat, that was the deal, eating. So she's now confused and added something to God's prohibition. This is the first legalism. And introduced right here by Eve. Who was the first legalist? Eve. Because she didn't pay attention close enough, apparently. This is an occupational hazard for all believers. But particularly for women. This is why God gives women an extra authority. It's for their protection. And failing that relationship is failing God. And either not orienting to the authority or the authority not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Either way. And the serpent said to the woman, he's impugned God already. God's holding out on you. He's told you can't have some of this, right? And let's focus on what you can't have. Oh, the tree. Yeah, okay. That's the one. Yeah. Let's go there. Now the serpent said to the woman, you absolutely dying, you will not die. As a matter of fact, all he does is takes a negative and negates the very statement God had said. Dying, you will die, which is a Hebrew idiom for you absolutely are certainly going to die. There's no way around it. It's absolute certainty. And she comes, the serpent says, not dying, you will die. You don't believe that, do you? God wouldn't do that. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened. And you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw the tree was good for food, it looks like it's good, tasty. And that it was a delight to the eyes. Very pleasant tree even. You know, nice looking. Aesthetically pleasing. And that the tree was desirable to make one wise. Well, these three things were too much for her. Four. She took the fruit and ate. And she gave to her husband with her, and he ate, and the eyes of both of them were open. Well, see, Satan told them partial truths. The eyes of them would be open. They would suddenly understand the difference between good and evil. They were innocent prior to this. But did they become like God? Ooh, no, that part was a lie. That part was a brutal lie that killed them. And no, you're not like God at all. You know, you may recognize good and evil, but you're not like God. Well, two, she added the legalistic prohibition about touching it. Three, she had a lack of discernment, which was manifested by engaging with the serpent. By the way, if you go home and your pets start talking to you, call somebody here at the church. Let them know. And we'll come and maybe talk to you. But shouldn't Eve have been a little puzzled that this is the first animal that ever talked to her? That would stand out to me like a sore thumb. This has never happened before. And apparently she, for whatever reason, doesn't think it's weird. But it's weird. You know. And obviously the snake wasn't, it's not like a cobra. They didn't slime around on the ground like they do now and all of that. The snake had legs because it was mobile. And apparently very attractive. And you still see some of that in the coloration of certain snakes, even the more deadly of them. Some of them are beautiful. Yeah. To look at. So, first, she manifests a lack of discernment. This is a part of the Eve, we call it the Eve complex. And because of this, people say, well, see, you hate women, you're down on women, you're a misogynist. No. No, but I know biblically that women are weaker vessels. I know that they lack discernment about a lot of stuff. I know that they're more easily manipulated than men. That doesn't, on the other hand, does that say men can't be manipulated? Oh, no, of course not. Of course they can. Anyway, and there are some women have more discernment than some men I know. So I'm not saying it, but as a general rule, these are the things that come out of the Eve deal. Lack of discernment, lack of clarity, legalism. She apparently did not inform Adam until after the fact. She's hiding things from her husband. And any woman that's doing that, you better know right now, you're out of fellowship and you're wrong. There's no reason for you to hide things from your husband. He's the authority. Yeah, well, he's not as smart as I am. Well, I'm sure you think that. I'm sure you think that. But that's not appropriate. So why do people hide things anyway? They're guilty. They're guilty of something. They don't want people to know about it. Whatever it may be. In this case, it's talking to an animal. Maybe Adam would have had a talk to you. What? Really? Uh-huh. Yeah, that'd be hard to believe, but okay. So she's with him, though, at the end. Well, five, she usurped authority by taking the lead in eating. That's another thing. Usurping authority. This is a part of the Eve complex. This is something women have to particularly fight. And then, again, you factor that a woman already has this trend in many cases. And then you factor that in with some of the doctrinal abuses and authority abuses that happen. And women very often feel justified in doing undoctrinal things because, quote, it's in their best interest. I'm not telling my husband this stuff because it's in his best interest not to know. Is it? Is it really? Yeah, well, doing things like this just manifests the Eve complex. Well, D, while Adam may have manifested certain behaviors leading up to the fall, the fact is, we don't know what they were. Everything appears to be copacetic. Everything, the only real report we get about the garden is right there at the end of chapter 2. That's the only real report we get. And verse 25, the man and his wife were both naked and did nothing to make themselves ashamed. That everything was apparently just glorious. That there's no problems that we know about at all. So one, he allowed the woman to lead him, forfeiting his position of authority. Well, he may have had behaviors. These were not sinful. The only sin was eating. It was the only sin they could commit was eating. They could think about it. They could talk about it. Again, they could play around the tree. They could knock fruit off of it, do whatever they want, play baseball with it. But they could do anything. Just couldn't eat. But may have played a part in the fall. So he allowed the woman to lead him, forfeiting his position of authority. When a man allows his authority to be usurped by a woman, he's failing as a man. That's not what men are supposed to be doing. This is not what men are. But again, an entire generation now has been essentially emasculated by women who think they know everything. The feminist mystique and all these other things that they think they know. And the fact is, this is all just blowback from the 60s in many cases, not and before. And the reality is, it has taken society completely apart, pretty much. And you can trace most of the ills and woes of society to failure in parents, authorities, and home life. How do you judge the decay of society? By the decay of the lives that are in it. And what's our society doing? It's gradually circling the toilet as it goes down. It's getting worse and worse, as we know. Well, two, he chose to maintain his allegiance to Eve instead of God. Adam was not deceived as to the issues. 1 Timothy 2:14 is Paul's commentary on this and sheds a fair amount of light on this matter of women. First, it deals with their place in the body, the local body. And that Paul, a part of apostolic teaching, is he did not allow women to be literally better here in verse 12, to be teachers or to be authorities over a man, to occupy these positions. It's not so much talking about the act itself as the position that one occupies. A teacher or an authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, then Eve. Paul argues from the order of creation that there is a primacy to man. This has been called, again, misogynistic. It's not. God does something in an order for a reason. And why the fact that he creates the man first indicates that the woman is subservient to him. In the creation of the woman, you see that she's subservient to him. She comes out of his side. And there's, again, many lessons there. But it was not Adam who was deceived. First, he argues from the order of creation that men are supposed to be in charge of this world. You say, well, that's a patriarchal society. Yeah, one that God designed. And I'm not going to apologize for it. So that's just unfortunately the way it is. And the only women this really upsets are maladjusted women. And Lord knows I've dealt with enough of those in my ministry over the years. But it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman. And there's, again, you wouldn't get this from the English. There's a stronger term here. Ex apatao. The woman being completely faked out. She was absolutely oblivious. What did Eve think she was doing? She thought she was leading them to utopia. Let me phrase it another way. She thought she was leading them to the Garden of Eden. Where were they? She thought she's leading them to a better life. You're not leading people to a better life by violating doctrine. How in the world do you ever believe that? That is as foolish as anything. So she, being completely, totally faked out, absolutely deceived, fell into transgression. And Satan had his way with her. Simply, he outthought her and had her wrapped around the axle and nothing flat. But he didn't do that. He couldn't do that, apparently, to Adam. That didn't work for him. So he knew that Adam's weak spot, though. It's his wife. It's his woman. That's his weak spot. Absent her, he'll be lonely again. So let's attack there. And so he did. And here, the idea is that... But again, note too, that the fall is never blamed on Eve. The fall of man and the introduction of the sin nature. It's always blamed on Adam because he's the authority. That's where the buck stops. It's with the authority. Okay, well, our time is gone there. We're going to have to stop today. We will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to socialize, fellowship with the people of the truth. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our growth. In Christ's name, amen.